Hi, and welcome to the very first episode of the Asymptote podcast. My name's Emma Jacobs, and I'm so excited to be kicking off this new feature of the journal. Since you're listening to this, you probably already know a bit about us, but just in case you don't, Asymptote is an online journal of literature and translation. You can find all of our content for free at www.asymptotejournal.com. We're a truly international bunch of people. We come from over 25 different countries, and we've all come together to bring you global fiction, poetry, non-fiction, visual art, and now, stories across the airwaves. And in episode one, we're looking at mythology, not only in the traditional epic sense, but also in terms of the myths that we build around ourselves as part of our everyday lives. This episode will be broken up into two installments, and throughout the show we'll be making our way to Israel, scaling the Caucasus Mountains, and travelling via ancient Greece to modern Amsterdam. But first up, we're heading to Venezuela, and the story of one of the most elusive figures in indigenous culture. Here's Erin Gilbert.
I want to introduce you to Maria Leonza, but I don't even know what name to use. Gods may be known by many names, and Maria Leonza is no exception. Approximately one-third of Venezuela's population might be counted as Maria Leonceros, and she draws followers from other Latin American countries as well. They refer to her reverently as La Reina, the Queen, and affectionately as the Mother. She might be called by her indigenous mortal name, Yara, or by one of her titles, Princess of the Indians, Saint, Goddess, one of the Three Powers. The Venezuelan filmmaker John Petrozelli's documentary about her is called Maria Leonza, Breath of Orchids. Scholars would point out that her name is a corruption of Maria de la Onza, sometimes translated as Maria of the Boar, but more often translated as Maria of the Jaguar, and left at that, even though the creature called Onza is actually a cryptid, a legendary beast that has never been proven to exist, described as resembling an especially ferocious cougar or lynx. One of the most widely accepted versions of her story begins with her birth at the dawn of the 16th century. In some stories about her, her eyes were a watery green, and seeing this, her father recognized her as a child foretold by prophecy, a child he was meant to sacrifice. In some stories, he defied the prophecy and instead sent his daughter into hiding in a mountain cave. She grew up safely, but one day when she stood in a river, a giant anaconda swam up to her, and wanting to possess her, the anaconda swallowed her whole. Maria Leonza could not be contained, however, and she emerged from the snake as a goddess, shedding the snake as the snake sheds its skin. She became both the embodiment and protectress of the mountain, the waters, and all the flora and fauna that had protected her. Physical representations of Maria Leonza vary as well. A massive statue presiding over Caracas depicts her as a muscular indigenous woman riding naked astride a tapir, holding a pelvic bone high above her head like a halo. She scowls on the cover of a comic book. In a tattoo, she smiles as sweetly as a pinup girl. In a painting, she writhes in ecstasy. On a candle, her mouth curves slightly, her lips pursed in the prim expression common among mass-produced images of saints. Her black hair is long and loose, or braided, or arranged in an elaborate hairstyle involving waves and curls. Her eyes are black or brown or green. The color of her skin is brown or white or gold. She wears a crown, a cape, white satin and lace, delicate gold earrings. She wears a feather headdress and a leather loincloth. She wears nothing. When belief in Maria Leonza became more widespread in the middle of the 20th century, Venezuelan writers began to develop her literary identity. As an emblem of the mestizo identity of Venezuela, she has been prohibited, celebrated, neglected, and rediscovered. The scholar and Spanish professor Elizabeth Nichols shows where the symbolic power of Maria Leonza, once associated almost exclusively with the most marginalized parts of society, can be found at the heart of the nation's literature. Nichols identifies a poem by the contemporary Venezuelan poet Yolanda Pantin, which captures the ambiguity of the goddess, who symbolizes immense spiritual power as well as the subjugation of women and indigenous peoples.
Salve reina, que estás en las aguas.
Hail the queen who remains in the waters. I pronounce this prayer before your statue, but you don't exist except in the maternal bone.
Ask me who Maria Leonza really was, and I cannot tell you. I don't have the right. I am too far removed from her history, her believers, and the mountain where they say she still resides. Nor will I attempt to define her, as so many others have done. If I have learned one thing about her, it is this. She's too powerful, too protean to be constrained. She sheds the rigid outlines of narrow definitions, like an anaconda shedding dead skin.
That piece was written by Erin Gilbert and included music from Maria Pien, Kevin MacLeod, and Tuck Anacoy. The poetry you heard was quoted from Elizabeth Nichols' translation of El Hueso Pélvico by Yolanda Pantin. So, all this talk of mythology got me thinking about one particular image. It's just a humble pattern of lines wriggling over the page, but it can be traced through our imaginations for thousands of years, all the way from ancient Greek and Native American legends, through Indian tantric texts, medieval Christianity, into the stories of Borges, the art of Escher, right up to modern video games. And that is the labyrinth. Once you start thinking about them, labyrinths are everywhere. Trust me, I now cannot switch my brain off from noticing them. Every time you get on the subway or shop at IKEA, you're entering a labyrinth. And then there's cyberspace, the biggest, craziest maze of all. A garden of forking hyperlinks that grows faster than we could ever keep track of. So what is it about labyrinths that we find so captivating? I guess it's got to do with being lost. And being lost is a feeling that's full of contradictions. It's imprisoning and intoxicating. It inspires dread and wonder. But I think the thing that's uniquely enchanting and sinister about the labyrinth, as opposed to other spaces you might get lost in, is that it's man-made. The labyrinth is not something that exists in nature. It's rigorously designed by some kind of shadowy manipulator, something human, yet elusive. The original labyrinth of Greek mythology was built by the mortal Daedalus, but it was so complex that he struggled to find the way out of his own creation. It had taken on an inhuman pulse of its own. And our modern labyrinths are equally suspended between the earthly and the otherworldly. Think of the paranormal darkness of the maze in horror films like The Shining, Dracula, Pan's Labyrinth. Because the labyrinth is built by human hands, it feels like there's a logic to it we could figure out if only we could wrap our brains around it. But we can't, and it breathes and swarms with the unknown. Which is what makes this one theory about the origins of the labyrinth so compelling to me. People disagree about the roots of the Greek word labyrinthos. Some say it came from the double-headed axe, or the word for quarry, or that there really was a monumental labyrinth within King Minos's palace. But the theory that convinces me most is Jan Piper's idea that the labyrinth is nothing more or less than the city itself. Just take a giant leap of imagination for a minute, and picture yourself living in ancient Greece. You've never seen a gathering of people larger than your village, or infrastructure more complex than your house. Imagine after miles of nothingness, you come across a building, and then a whole cluster of buildings, and then a knot of branching streets, and then there you are, in the thickening center of it, lost in the buzzing, steaming, blaring madness of the city. This place is made by men, but it is not human. It beats to a distinct rhythm, but not one you can decipher. You might just find yourself believing there's something monstrous at the heart of it, something half beast, half man, something at once mortal and divine. When the word labyrinth first came into use, Knossos was newly formed and no one around had seen anything like it. But still today, arriving in an unknown city, or even one we're familiar with, most of us have felt that panicked euphoria of entering the labyrinth. And when you stand at the top of a skyscraper and look down at the writhing maze below, the mythology makes sense. It seems pretty feasible that the myth of the labyrinth spun out of mankind's first encounters with this strange and epic new being, a creature that we built ourselves, but cannot control.
I never actually heard that etymological theory, but that is wonderful.
That's Jan Gru, a Norwegian writer and Asymptote contributor.
There's definitely something primal going on there, redescribing the notion of forbidden or sanctified space.
In his short story, The Minotaur, Jan uproots the mythological creature from ancient Greece and transplants him into the heart of 21st century Amsterdam.
I grew up in a city that was not planned at all. I mean, Oslo is several villages that grew together semi-spontaneously, whereas Amsterdam and St. Petersburg and a few other cities are extremely planned. And so they're fascinating to me in that somebody's trying to construct a perfectly rational environment. Of course, it's never worked out that way in practice.
That's another way we can think of the labyrinth, as an attempt to rationalize the irrational by imposing a design upon the chaos. Like the careful geometry of Amsterdam's canals, or like the act of crafting a story.
Every new story or every new book, if it has any ambitions at all, will be a little bit like a labyrinth in that you have to navigate it as an unfamiliar space right at the beginning. So it works as a figure for the experience of reading as well.
Here's Jan reading an excerpt from the story, as translated by Becky Crook.
In the end, the Minotaur settled in Amsterdam. He was no longer young, and it had become increasingly difficult for him to travel undetected between the continents. After many years, he decided he would have to make his home in a large city somewhere in Europe, a reasonable distance by train from his Greek homeland. Paris was too carefully planned, with its straight boulevards, and Berlin was too spacious, too open. The Dutch city reminded him of the labyrinth, the first home that the Minotaur had known. The city center was unchanged since last he had been there, which was sometime between the peace in Westphalia and the Napoleonic Wars. The same filth, the same human crowd. The smells had changed, though. There were no longer horses, but cars, and the stench of the canals held a machine-like odor nowadays. But it was an organic city. It was a living being. It pulsated the way the labyrinth did. He felt at home within the city's heart. The Minotaur had lived too long. For all he knew, he was the only one of his kind that still existed in the world. And he was exhausted. His mighty horns were marked with dents and scratches. Throughout the years, he had growled and butted and gored, but he couldn't do this anymore. Sometimes he was proud of his horns and the gouges in them. Other times he woke from a dream in which they had fallen out and new horns were beginning to sprout from his temples. Soft, smooth horns covered by a thin membrane and with infinitely sharp, fine points. Heavy narcotics didn't much appeal to the Minotaur, but he smoked marijuana. For a long time, he had tried not to smoke every day, so that the experience would still mean something. Now and then, he had managed to abstain for a week, before rolling something very potent and dreaming of the Oracle of Delphi. The smoke in the cramped apartment became the smoke from the mountain, and Pythia's face filled his consciousness. But what she told him, this he never remembered when he awoke. Now his routine was more monotonous. He slept for most of the day. When evening rolled around, he forced himself to get up. He rarely went for more than an hour before lighting up his first joint. After that, he wandered around the dark city in increasingly larger circles, until he lost his sense of direction. He was still able to dream as long as he was moving. Sometimes he imagined that he was at home. The brick houses became walls, the constellations became his old friends, and he himself became one of his old victims. He waited for himself, somewhere within the labyrinth. One time, an aimless night in Amsterdam had turned into a grey dawn. The Minotaur found himself farther from home than he had ever been, far away from the canals. He saw a man riding a bicycle from the other side of the street. The man wobbled and fell, and it was only then that the Minotaur heard the shots. The cyclist staggered across the street before another man in a grey rain jacket, shot him several times. Then the man pulled a long knife from his grey rain jacket and cut the cyclist's throat. The Minotaur smelled blood immediately. His eyes were opened. The man in the grey rain jacket stabbed the knife into the cyclist's chest and the cyclist lay still. Then he pulled out a piece of paper, wrote something on it, and pinned it to the body with another, smaller knife. He lifted his gaze and looked at the Minotaur. And the Minotaur knew that the man saw him just as he was. The Minotaur stretched himself up to his full height. He tossed his head and raised his horns. The man in the grey rain jacket went his own way. Many people had begun gathering at the scene. The air was cold and dank, as always. The Minotaur plodded back toward the center. The Minotaur wandered farther around in the grey light. He didn't return home until it began to darken. His body stopped at a window on the ground floor. The sweet, spicy light fell across his coat and hat, across his face. For the second time that day, someone met his gaze.
To hear the rest of the story, head over to our October issue, where you can find that and many, many more literary labyrinths to get lost in. And that's the idea that I want to end with, the notion of writing as the building of a labyrinth, because I think it gets to the root of why we create myths at all. Like the Minotaur of Jan's story, humankind is driven by an impossible impulse to tame wildness, both in our surroundings, through the construction of cities, and within our psyches. So I wonder if the labyrinth is partly just a visual metaphor for our inability to map our own minds. We try to lay down a trail, navigate a single path, but we're forever getting lost in dark corners and dead ends and inescapable feedback loops. This is the world of the unknowable and the mystical, the world of the Minotaur, the world of Maria Leonza. And maybe this world is the reason why we long to be lost just as much as we fear it. Because it's here that we find the greatest stories and become the makers of our own myths. This episode was produced by Erin Gilbert, Kate Nick-Gonal, Tim Ellison, Mirza Puric, Florian Dowsons, and myself, with help from Li Yu Leong. Huge thanks also go out to Elisa Tabor, Joseph Sabo, and of course, Yang Gru. In this segment, you heard music from Jari Pitcannon, Ergo Fismas, Costa T, Jazzar, and Simon Mathewson. And if you're a fan of the journal, we'd love your support. Yep, here's the bit where I ask you for money. Asymptote depends entirely on donations from readers like you. So if you believe that sharing ideas and art across language barriers is a worthwhile goal, please help us to continue doing so. We've just launched our Indiegogo campaign to raise much-needed funds so that we can keep on bringing you the best of world literature, as well as developing other projects, not least this podcast. We would be so grateful for any donation you can give. And if you chip in, we'll say a heartfelt thank you with asymptote bags, posters, books, and even tickets to our upcoming anniversary events. Huge thanks to those of you who have helped so far. We'll be back soon with part two of our mythology episode, in which we'll trace the line from J.R.R. Tolkien to Esperanto to Georgian folk music and grapple with the tough and relevant topic of the mythologizing of Israel. Hope to see you then, and in the meantime, head to www.asymptotejournal.com for more strange and beautiful stories in our mythology issue. Thanks for listening.